Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We have a program today where conversations about war and about love and beauty live with conversations about death and dying. And normally, this is kind of a problem for radio programs and journalists. Death, that's too ponderous. Toss beauty in there, it's going to feel random. William Blake to the rescue. To see a world in a grain of sand and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour. This hour, some words of poet William Blake reminds us that love and death and beauty coexist. And when they don't, it's a problem. We will trace a doctor's difficult path in facing death in his patients and his own family, and how they all are trying to put some more spiritual beauty back into the experience of death in America. Blake, who explored death and beauty, heaven and hell, in all of his vast body of work, his writings, his poems, his ghastly and beautiful prints, you should check them out. Art can never exist without naked beauty displayed, he once wrote. Later this hour, we'll talk about the naked beauty of fashion. Is it art or a form of enslavement? Lots more in the program and a few more gems from William Blake, if you listen carefully. But our first thoughts are those of grief for the family of American hostage Kayla Jean Mueller. Just a few days ago, they were awaiting proof of life for the only known remaining U.S. hostage being held by the Islamic State. Today, confirmation that the 26-year-old humanitarian worker is dead. ISIS claims killed by a Jordanian airstrike, as though that means, if confirmed, they bear no responsibility for her death. Joining me now from the Jordanian capital, Amman, is Rana Swice, freelance journalist for the New York Times. Welcome back, Rana.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the reaction in Jordan? Certainly the claim by ISIS that it was an airstrike that killed Ms. Mueller is not necessarily credible.
Yes, as you know, we cannot get any confirmation that it was Jordanian jets that bombed that building in particular, and also that, in fact, Kayla was actually there and not murdered before the air campaign. So I think in Jordan, we have spoken to government officials when the ISIS announced this at the beginning, and there was vehemently they were denying that they would do such a thing, or if not that it's not possible, but we have no confirmation.
And can you remind us of just how manipulative ISIS or the ISIS negotiators were when there was supposedly negotiations going on for the Jordanian pilot, who we later learned was burned alive in a cage?
Yes. At the beginning, they asked for Kenji Goto in exchange for a militant that was a would-be suicide bomber in 2005, responsible for the bombing of three hotels in Jordan, that she was put on death row but was awaiting sentencing. And what happened was Jordanians said that they would exchange Sajida Arishawi, the would-be bomber, for Kenji Goto and proof of life that Muad is actually alive. And that did not happen. And they kept saying that, you know, if you don't give us Sajida, we will kill him. But in fact, he was already killed for 1 month.
And that means that it's conceivable that Kayla had been dead for quite some time.
Yes.
What are Jordanian
exactly.
officials saying about that?
Actually, ISIS said they would kill her if the family didn't pay nearly $7 million by August 13, 2014. This is according to a source that's close to the family. And what happened after the deadline is totally unclear. So we don't know what happened. Exactly. One of the things that people here are suspecting is that she was already dead, unfortunately.
So there's been really no news of her since August.
Yes, that is correct.
All right. Moving forward now, in Jordan, what's the political reaction to these developments? And since the pilot was killed and since the executions took place of the ISIS detainees, what's happened?
Well, Jordan has stepped up. It's thousands of troops are now, according to NBC News, thousands of troops have been deployed to the Iraqi border. This is the latest that we are hearing as it ramps up its campaign against ISIS, who of course, as you said, set our Jordanian pilot ablaze. Also, the troops were sent, according to NBC, to prevent the infiltration of ISIS fighters into Jordan, and at the same time as a show of force. Jordan has unleashed up to approximately 20 missions per day by Jordanian jets targeting ISIS positions in Syria. The UAE and its F-16s have been stationed in Jordan and took part in airstrikes. Of course, the UAE stopped its air campaign after Muad al-Kasasbi, the Jordanian pilot, was kidnapped by ISIS.
But his it seems as though the UAE has resumed its participation in the coalition. Rana Swaifs, freelance journalist for The New York Times, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We turn now to Russia and Ukraine. President Obama met with German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the White House on Monday. And while the allies tried to present a united front, it's clear they're at odds when it comes to the best way of confronting Vladimir Putin's aggression in eastern Ukraine. Here's President Obama, who wants to arm the Ukrainian military to better fight the Russian-backed rebels.
In the face of this aggression and these bad decisions, we can't simply try to talk them out of it. We have to show them that the world is unified in imposing a cost for this aggression. And that's what we're going to continue to do.
But German Chancellor Merkel says she's sticking to talk and diplomacy for now.
We continue to pursue a diplomatic solution, although we have suffered a lot of setbacks. These days we will see whether all sides are ready and willing to come to a negotiated settlement. I've always said I don't see a military solution to this conflict, but we have to put all our efforts in bringing about a diplomatic solution.
Tomorrow, Angela Merkel will meet with the leaders of Russia, Ukraine, and France in Minsk in Belarus to pursue that diplomatic solution. Is this division among the allies playing into the hands of Moscow? With The View from Moscow, joining us is Dmitry Babich, political analyst for Radio Sputnik. Welcome back, Dmitry.
Yes, nice to hear from you.
So I gather it was pretty entertaining watching that news conference of President Obama and Angela Merkel yesterday pretend that they didn't completely disagree.
Well, I think that the situation is indeed dramatic, and I keep coming back to the origins of this crisis. Somehow in the Western media, usually they trace it back to the takeover of Crimea, but I think our listeners are people with good memories, so they remember that everything started 5 months earlier when the Maidan protest action started in Kiev. So I keep thinking, was it worth it? You know, just Ukraine's association agreement with the European Union, was it worth it?
All right, but this is the plan, though, right, to divide Obama and Merkel and Germany and the United States, and Putin must be dancing there in the Kremlin, right?
Absolutely not. What Russia wants is just a freeze of the fighting.
So what's the problem? Why can't Vladimir Putin get the Russian-backed rebels to stop fighting?
Well, the problem is that these are not Russian-backed rebels attacking Kiev. These are the forces sent by Kiev attacking and bombing Donetsk and Lugansk. Look where the destructions are taking place. They're taking place in the region where people traditionally voted for pro-Russian parties, which are no longer existing in Ukraine under the new regime. The problem is that Kiev doesn't send serious people to the negotiations with the rebels.
Does Russia want to expand its borders into eastern Ukraine?
Certainly not. Russia could easily do it, but this is not the intention of the authorities here, because Russia is not about territorial expansion. Crimea was an exception because the population there is indeed predominantly Russian, and if it had not been taken back to Russia, it could become NATO base on the Black Sea, and it would be a very dangerous situation because Sevastopol is full of retired Russian Navy officers or Soviet Navy officers. So it's just, for me, it's inconceivable that Sevastopol would become a NATO base.
Let's talk about some things that we've been told over the last couple of weeks. Vladimir Putin began this conflict. He wants to continue it. And it's very important for him internally. He's telling the Russian people, look what happens to you if you prefer Europe over Russia.
How can Russians prefer Europe over Russia? You know, just imagine people in the United States saying, having to choose, do you prefer United States over Europe? Of course, people in the United States would say, yes, we prefer the United States. So it's just very strange to say that Putin is trying to, talk Russians from doing something that they have never been offered to do. Russia would like to become a part of the West.
What will happen if the U.S. arms forces in Ukraine?
That's going to be a very dangerous situation because it would mean creating another Afghanistan in the center of Europe. Remember that arming the Afghan rebels was one of the factors that led to 9/11 in the United States. When we just tried to recall all of the instances when the United States armed certain armies or certain armed groups abroad, it always led to some very dangerous developments. In Ukraine, it's going to lead to the most dangerous developments probably since 1945.
Do you believe that the rebel forces in eastern Ukraine are directly supported by Russian authorities?
I think that Russia supplies food and money and everything the people there need to live because the
Including
Ukrainian
arms?
Government... No, I don't think the arms are supplied by the government. I'll explain you why Russia is supplying food and all the electricity and gas. Because the Ukrainian government stopped all the banking activity on these territories.
What will happen if there's no agreement in Minsk?
The fighting will continue. The people in Donetsk and Lugansk will not surrender. I'm afraid that Mr. McCain and others will have their way in supplying weapons to the new regime in Ukraine. And we shall be moving into a very, very dangerous new era.
Dmitry Babich, political analyst for Radio Sputnik in Moscow. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Words about beauty from you. And later this hour, we are drafting you to think like poet William Blake on Twitter at Beth Martinetti. She writes, I never felt more beautiful than when I was pregnant with my rainbow baby.
This is Deborah from New York. Beauty is truth you feel now.
My name is Sean Regan from Roswell, Georgia. My definition of beauty is an ideal that defies description.
Succinct thoughts about beauty. Later this hour, the daughter of a supermodel, Amanda Filipacchi. She's the author of The Unfortunate Importance of Beauty. Her novel explores how external ideas of beauty control our lives.
When you're in the habit of wearing makeup, it feels very, to me, it felt very uncomfortable to go a day without makeup. I wouldn't want anyone to see me without makeup if they're used to seeing me with makeup, you know, and vice versa. Now that I never wear makeup, if I had to suddenly show myself to someone while wearing makeup, I'd feel embarrassed.
Our hashtag is MyBeautyIs. Continue the conversation. Call us at 877-8MyTake. Share a photo by tweeting us at The Takeaway. The hashtag again, MyBeautyIs. Or just post a picture to facebook.com/TheTakeaway. What's your definition of beauty?
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Death is terrible, though born on angel's wings, says poet William Blake. Blake was fascinated with death and beauty and love and art. He once said, art is the tree of life, but science is the tree of death. He said that 200 years ago. Perhaps he anticipated the frustrations of Dr. Atul Gawande, would have in dealing with death as a modern surgeon armed with all the latest scientific advances, who discovered with one of his patients how powerless he was. Lung cancer patient Sarah Monopoly declined swiftly, as most people do with lung cancer, and as she became more impaired, Sarah's husband Rich kept hoping another treatment would work.
I've thought often about what did that cost us? What did we miss out on? What did we forego by consistently pursuing treatment after treatment after treatment, which made her sicker and sicker and sicker.
Rich and Sarah Monopoly's experience is one of the stories that Gawande shares in a new Frontline film produced by our partner WGBH, the documentary called Being Mortal, and it's based on Gawande's book of the same name. Doctor, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
It's so nice to talk to you on this very somber but in a certain way beautiful subject of people coming to terms with this moment, and some people doing it in a way that's more poetic and artful than others. And I would suspect that you wouldn't put the healthcare system in the artful community at this point.
No. One of the things that I really puzzle over is why, even in my own practice, I've done such a, you know, not a great job with helping people to the end phase of their life. We always have something more we can offer. There's always something more we're going to say we can do. We can put you in the ICU. We can give you, you know, your most likely week you'll have surgery in your life is the last week of your life, and that's a week you'll get no benefit from it.
And in thinking about your previous books, particularly the checklist book, you very meticulously, with the skill of a surgeon, kind of deconstruct this whole idea of why we make the choices we make in the last moments of life. Here's Kathy Selvagi, doctor of palliative care at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, talking about something that you go very, very deeply into here.
You know, we're all sort of taught that in order to make a difference in our patients' lives, we have to be doing something. We have to be operating, we have to be giving them a medication, we have to be radiating, we have to be giving chemotherapy. In some ways, I think the medicine is the easy part.
How much of a revelation was that idea?
It was actually a turning point for me. When I started talking and interviewing palliative care doctors, hospice nurses, and others, what they kept emphasizing was that people have priorities besides just living one more day. Those priorities may differ from person to person. It's a question of, you know, what matters most if time is short for you? What do you not want us to sacrifice along the way? You know, the most reliable way to know what people's priorities are is simply to ask. We don't ask. And that was the revelation to me. That I needed to ask. I needed to ask my patients, what are your fears for the future? What's most important to you if your time is short?
And the other thing that comes through in your book and in this film is just how medicine has kind of erased that moment of death, that moment of hopelessness. And here's that statement through the words of Rich Monopoly, who's the husband of one of your former patients, who is a very central story in this film.
We're all conditioned when the doctor comes out of the room and takes the mask off and says, there's nothing else we can do. In other words, I've thrown the kitchen sink at this patient and there's nothing else I can do. That's
your image of what the day will be that comes.
Correct.
But we always have something more we can do. That's the problem.
Right.
How did Sarah experience that dilemma, I suppose?
She was in her 9th month of pregnancy, 34 years old, and diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, not curable. We wanted to give her every possible treatment, every option that could be given. But we also, in our heart of hearts, would have said we wouldn't want to sacrifice things that are incredibly important to her. And yet we did. You know, right to the very last days of her life, she was getting radiation therapy, planning for experimental therapy. She was in the hospital. And Rich, her husband, talks about what it felt like. You could really see how horrible it was those final days. You know, for the last few weeks of her life, she was so weak she couldn't even hold her baby, and they never had that chance, and that's what still causes him pain.
There's been such an interest and importance stressed on the last words in death as an experience in European and American history particularly. Can you trace that history and how the Monopoly family really lost that because of the choices we make in healthcare?
Well, it's a couple of things that happened. One is that it's a consequence of the great advantages we got from science. You know, we have been able to help people live far longer, defeat diseases that otherwise would have shortened our lives. And so we now turn to medicine for that option of prolonging lives. And it's prolonged life, and it's often incredibly successful. And so one consequence is that we have uncertainty about when those moments might be arriving and when they don't. Second is that we often don't really know what it means to be dying. In the film and in the book, I describe people who have terminal illness, even my own father. But he didn't die for 4 years after the diagnosis. So was he dying? And when was he dying? And when are we talking about final last words? I even puzzle over what does it even mean to say people are dying these days, because it becomes such a long and drawn out course.
You describe an important difference between what hospice physicians do and what you do as someone who tries to extend life. What is that difference?
And I learned this actually talking to a hospice nurse. What she said to me is, look, medicine sacrifices your time now for the sake of time later. But what she saw her job as was that at a certain point when time later becomes less and less possible, she wanted to use our medical capabilities to assure you had the best possible day today, regardless of the consequence for the future. And ironically, when you do that at that end stage of people's lives, people actually live longer.
So finally, you believe that your death and the death of your patients and your family will be much more satisfying experience as a result of all of this.
Yes, I think that being able to make clear with your own family and with your clinicians what is most important to you, what matters most, what your fears are, what your priorities are, what you're willing to sacrifice and what you're not willing to sacrifice along the way, makes it so when you come to the end, it's not where you don't want to be.
Atul Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital and author of Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. His thoughts and his book will be brought to life in a Frontline special produced by our partner WGBH. The documentary Being Mortal is airing on PBS tonight on most PBS stations. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As America begins to understand the consequences of more than a decade of two wars, the place where former soldiers, civilians, and their families go to find common ground is increasingly the movies. War movies have become something of a forum for exploring how wars have changed the military, changed America, and how they have created a host of social problems we will be dealing with for much of this century. Certainly the box office success of American Sniper, as well as how it has been viewed different ways as a pro-war and anti-war movie, is a case in point. How soldiers and veterans are portrayed has become a vital concern for Hollywood studios, filmmakers, and veterans. One group of veterans thinks there is an opportunity right now to take control of how soldiers are portrayed in the movies. They've begun working with filmmakers in Hollywood to create a special certification for films that show veterans behaving normally. One of those veterans is Chris Marvin. He's a retired captain and Army helicopter pilot who was injured in Afghanistan. His certification group he's part of is called Got Your Six.
As long as we're showing veterans on film and television in a reasonable and accurate light, we can address difficult issues, we can show very heroic veterans, but most of the time what we're looking for is normal, everyday people, everyday characters who may happen to be veterans. And we know that this will improve the way that the general population is perceiving veterans as they return to their communities. You know, I'll go back just a year to a film like Lone Survivor, that was a great view into the way combat in Afghanistan happened, as well as a film that the filmmakers took a lot of time to consult with experts on how they should be portraying it and how these individuals would interact with each other. And of course, you know, films like Unbroken and American Sniper, which are both in theaters right now, we think are going to be great candidates for Six Certified.
Is there a film that caused you personally to get, you know, a little up in arms about the way veterans were being portrayed that symbolized to you why this is necessary?
There wasn't a moment for me when I was sitting in a theater and said, oh my gosh, we have to change this. But, you know, I was actually interviewed years ago when the film Brothers came out. And that film, as I look back on it, had some factual inaccuracies that lead to, I think, a problem with credibility. One of the examples is that there was a Black Hawk helicopter flying by itself in combat. Well, I flew Black Hawk helicopters, and I know that we don't ever do that. We always fly with other helicopters. And then later on in the film, of course, they really dove, I would say, off the deep end into what was implicitly post-traumatic stress disorder, and had, you know, the character having a gunfight with police officers and digging a bunker in his front yard. And not to say those things aren't theoretically feasible. It's just such a depiction on the far end of the spectrum that those would throw up major questions for the Six Certified Committee if we saw something like that again.
What did you think of Black Hawk Down?
Black Hawk Down is an interesting film for me because I was in flight school learning how to fly Black Hawks when it came out. You know, I think that it's certainly a different era of war, which immediately makes it challenging for young veterans like me. So when I look at films about Vietnam, about World War II, even about Somalia, I wasn't in the military at that time, and I didn't fight in those combat zones. So for me, I think Black Hawk Down was a great film that portrayed a lot of the values that the military has. But, you know, I'd certainly want to consult with someone who's in the military at that time to really get some real information on it.
Here's a clip from the Mindy Project.
Oh, I love your t-shirt. Did you get that at Urban Outfitters?
Oh, no. I got it from the Army. They give you them for free when you join. I just got back from Afghanistan.
I gotta tell you, I've been a big fan of SEAL Team 6 way before you guys killed Bin Laden.
Cool. I'm not in SEAL Team 6.
I got you. You're not in SEAL Team 6.
I'm really not.
I hear you.
So what would you say about that portrayal? And here you've got a veteran interacting with the clearly non-clued-in population in the United States about military life.
You know, that episode of the Mindy Project is something that we have talked about a lot at Got Your Six. Seth Rogen was actually the guest star playing the Army service member who was back from Afghanistan. And the fact that they can sort of throw humor at these everyday conversations that veterans are having with their community members really, I think, helps to tell the story in a way that isn't really heavy-handed on our side. I mean, we talk a lot about how veterans may not always love to be told thank you for your service. But it's not because we don't love being thanked. We do. We just want someone to have a conversation with us beyond that. It's just so many times it's thanks for your service. You know, I love SEAL Team 6. And the end of that clip is, let me get this guy a sandwich. And that was the end of it, right? And so it's a little bit contrived. And the fact that the Mindy Project could help us to bring that to light through humor was really, really effective.
If a movie was to be made about your story, what would you be most concerned about Hollywood getting right or wrong?
I think the main thing is that being in the military and being a veteran is a very formative part of my development, but it does not in any way, shape, or form define me, right? So if somebody was going to make a movie about me or write a book about me, I think that I would want them to explore who I am. Not just 7 years I spent in the military and possibly the after effects of that.
And in your case, you know, you have experienced combat and you were severely injured, right?
Yes.
And yet there are plenty of people who have had no experience who get to tell that story. You know, people in Hollywood, writers, journalists. Does that make you feel exposed and vulnerable?
I don't think so. You know, what we're trying to actually offer to those writers, content creators in Hollywood, and I guess maybe in someday to some degree even journalists, if they're interested, is real-life veterans to talk to. So if you're going to put a veteran character as a guest star in one episode of your sitcom, why not spend an hour talking to a real-life veteran? Because I'll tell you what, John, I would rather have other people making their best effort to tell my story and therefore my story getting heard and my story and the story of veterans like me than having that story fade away and not be told altogether.
Chris Marvin retired as a captain, an Army helicopter pilot who was severely injured when his helicopter crashed in Afghanistan back in 2004, part of an organization called Got Your Six, which seeks to inform the way the public sees veterans by certifying movies and other entertainment products. Chris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What does going to the movies say about your life? Bill from Seattle, Washington. My habits probably suggest that I'm fed up with political gridlock and would like to be far, far away. Guardians of the Galaxy was the best film of 2014, hands down. Joins the conversation. What do your movie-watching habits say about you at 877-8-MY-TAKE? That's our number.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
Tragic, useless beauty, Elvis Costello there. The beauty of desperation and fashion he was talking about. The whimsical eye blink of time that it takes for a fashion model to go from most wanted to most ignored. A brisk parade on a runway of time, and then it's all over.
My very first job was for Marshall Field.
If exuberance is beauty, as William Blake says, then this woman qualifies as both exuberant and beautiful. It's model Cindy Crawford on The David Letterman Show back in 1991, talking about her very first modeling job.
And they wanted me to do this bra ad.
All right.
I was lucky enough to, at 16, to already have something to put in it. So,
Paul, are you all right? I just lost my footing.
Okay?
I'm all right now.
Hear there the infantile laughter of men thinking about beauty and sexuality and confusing it all. But then that's the whole idea of fashion, to mix sexuality and classic untouchable beauty in some confused, breathtaking way.
Beauty is the experience of human sensory joy.
This listener seems to have a pretty good handle on all of this beauty, sexuality kind of thing. But this listener, on the other hand, wants to stay away from physical beauty.
I'm Timothy Cook from Seattle, and beauty is what inspires us to keep going.
My next guest grew up as the daughter of a model that people gawked at on the cover of Vogue and other magazines and on the street. Amanda Filipacchi would even stare at her mother, Ford model Sonia Peterson. Amanda did not inherit her mother's physical attributes. The accident of beauty is a theme in Amanda's new novel, The Unfortunate Importance of Beauty.
I have a sort of love-hate relationship with beauty. I think it's sad how important it is. It's kind of tragic. And yet I myself love it. I can't help it. You know, most people do. I was born in a family of very beautiful people. My mom was a top model, and my dad was also very good looking, and my brother too. And I didn't quite inherit their looks. So it's just a topic that interested me. And I didn't really set out to write a novel about beauty, but I know the classic fairy tales, they don't send a great message. You know, all the girls are always beautiful. Mm-hmm. They may be dirty, like Cinderella. They may be poor. Anything is fine, but you have to be beautiful. Otherwise, you're not worthy of a fairy tale. And that's unfortunate.
In your mother's case, was beauty effortless?
Yeah, she was breathtakingly beautiful.
Did you resent her for that?
No. I never had bad feelings at all, or negative feelings or jealousy towards my mother. I was entirely proud of her. There was one time a man I got to know was becoming slightly romantically interested in, and he came over to my apartment, and nothing had happened between us yet, and he was looking up at a beautiful photo of my mom shot by Irving Penn, and he said, "It must be hard to have a mother who's that beautiful." And I said, "No, not at all. It's great. I'm very proud of her." It turns out he was a jerk and nothing ever happened.
he sounds like a jerk.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you think that the beauty that is breathtaking to you, that you experienced in your family, is an absolute sort of immovable classic beauty, or is a function of society, context, you know, the things that, you know, were marketed to believe are beautiful?
Well, it's hard to know, because I think our tastes do get influenced. Like, I remember growing up, thick lips on women weren't considered particularly attractive. And I didn't consider them particularly attractive. And then as the years went on, that became very beautiful. And now I find them very attractive. We get influenced, I think, our taste in beauty. But nevertheless, there's something very interesting. I think it's also biological, because the cousin of Darwin, who was an anthropologist in 1883, he wanted to see if there was a difference between typical faces of vegetarians and typical faces of criminals. So he superimposed photographs of faces of vegetarians, and what he discovered was beauty. When you average out people's features, different people's features, you end up with a beautiful face. And it's a kind of a mind-blowing thought, because that's the last thing we think of normally as beauty.
Hmm. Although the Greeks would say, no, beauty is this ideal, this aspirational ideal, and that the sculptures that represent beauty in ancient Greece and in classical sculpture can never be found in the actual faces. And there are sculptures of actual faces from Greek and Roman times, and they're filled with, you know, specific moles and weird little spots that are specific to a particular individual. So what of this quality of beauty that's idealistic?
Well, you know, different people have different opinions. I'm not sure that the ideal Greek beauty is exactly our taste anymore.
Although we look at some of those sculptures, like, you know, David, mm-hmm. and not bad.
Yeah, not bad. I've seen better.
you're very well advanced. Yes.
I mean, you know, in some of our actors nowadays, you know, I find some much better looking than David, but, and that's just a question of...
Who, for instance?
Probably my favorite all time, but this was from years ago, was Carrie Hughes from The Princess Bride.
Oh.
Yeah.
Do you think we all have a type that we're associated with who's our kind of ideal beauty person?
Based on my experience of myself, I would say no. I've gone through phases, you know.
But in those individual phases, you had a type.
Yeah, but then there've also been time. I mean, after a certain point, I think my phases stopped. I no longer had a type or a phase, you know. I just was able to appreciate different types of people, different types of men. And another thing that I think is interesting is that I think women are able to fall in love with men sometimes for their talent. How often do you ever hear this happening the other way around? When do men ever fall in love with a woman because of her talent? I think that's too bad. You know, it's very sad for women.
What do you think of the fashion industry? Does it conceal or reveal beauty?
Probably both. I mean, I used to be fascinated by beauty. As a teenager, I would do airbrushed posters of my mother's modeling pictures and things like that. So I can understand, you know, the lure and people's love of it. But I was thinking recently, you know, if retouching of models on covers didn't exist, I think perhaps everyone would appreciate each other more.
Have you ever tried to use makeup and...
Oh, yeah.
And to do it in a way that makes you look fundamentally different and to basically put on a disguise that is someone who's just knocked down beautiful?
I used to wear makeup, and I used to believe in makeup. I used to really feel that it could make anybody look beautiful. And then after a certain age, when I was about 30, and I had to start wearing glasses, I thought, oh, well, forget about the makeup. What's the point if you have to wear glasses? The glasses ruin the whole effect anyway, so forget the makeup. And then actually there, too, my taste changed. And over the years, I started finding women who don't wear makeup more beautiful. Even beautiful blonde women, I actually think they look better without makeup.
Do you think we have control of beauty or beauty has control of us?
Both, but probably beauty has control of us more than the other way around. It would be good if we could make efforts to free ourselves a little bit of that, to sometimes try to see beauty in people, you know, give them a chance, sort of let it be an acquired taste. Our society always talks about inner beauty, that's what counts, all that, but we fail.
Well, Amanda Filipacchi, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Amanda Filipacchi is the author of The Unfortunate Importance of Beauty. Tomorrow, an exploration of inner beauty with a blind writer reflects on beauty that the eye does not see. You can follow me on Twitter at jhockenberry or listen back to anything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.